The following program is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. I'm Kurt Benrud. Welcome to Science Fiction Shorts, brought to you by a team of volunteer readers. Our program will be available in podcast after the initial broadcast.
My name is Jennifer Green, and I will be reading The Hotel of the Suicides by Mike Resnick and Sabina Theo. "What'll it be?" asked the man at the reception desk. "An apocalyptic death for two? Poison, perhaps? Or maybe you'd prefer to have us decide. It makes no difference in the price." "I'm not sure," said Eddie, staring at the discreet badge over the man's left pocket. "Leo Verini, psychologist." "Not to worry, sir. Here we all have more than one role, from the chef to the chambermaids." He smiled reassuringly. "Still, I understand your restlessness."
"My restlessness?" repeated Eddie.
"A moment ago, you began drumming your fingers, which could imply impatience, but it seems clear to me that you are uneasy."
"What would have happened if I'd begun biting my nails?" asked Eddie curiously.
"I'd have recommended the manicurist on the second floor," answered Verini with a laugh.
"All right, let's get down to business."
"You have read the booklet, haven't you?" replied Verini. Eddie nodded, recalling the photos of the azure blue waters and the towering green palms that surrounded the hotel.
"Are you bored with life?" the booklet gently whispered. "Do you seek a cessation to your problems and a beautiful death? Then consider Caribbean Delight, the exquisite setting where elegant corpses are just another part of life."
The more Eddie thought about it, the more he concluded that Caribbean Delight served a more important purpose than anyone gave it credit for. These people had run the race, and winners or losers, they had one thing in common, something you could read in every face. They were tired. And this place knew how to appeal to them. Its ads were tasteful, but the discerning could read between the lines. Their first client, a best-selling author, had died in his room, sexually exhausted from the efforts of two beautiful companions that had been provided by the hotel, which made sure that his blissful dead face appeared in every newspaper that was willing to run the photo. That was the start of a stunning exodus, first from the patrons' home countries, then from the world itself.
"Have you a last will and testament?" asked Verini.
"No."
"Not a problem," said Verini. "We'll arrange it later today." He paused. "One more thing. Theoretically, our visitors are here of their own will. But if even the slightest doubt exists in your mind that somebody, a relative, perhaps, has beguiled you here for mercenary motives, simply inform our client defense department and your problem will be solved immediately. I assure you that our connections are quite powerful."
"I'm here of my own free will," answered Eddie, taking the folder to a table and starting to fill it out. "Edward H. Smith, musician and composer, 34, single." It took him the better part of an hour to answer all the questions. Some were easy, height, weight, eye color, and some were more complex and very personal. Verini took the documents, glanced at them briefly, and filed them away, after which he asked,
"Have you decided already?"
"Not yet," answered Eddie.
"A sudden violent death, or something for the soul?"
"For the soul, I think."
Verini nodded his head knowingly.
"I am not surprised. Artists are gifted with exceptional imagination."
He lowered his voice confidentially. "Are you a masochist, or are you perhaps enthralled with sadism? I'll read the questionnaire, of course, but I want to form an initial picture. Do you want an exquisite spiritual experience without serious consequences to your bodily essence?"
Eddie shrugged. "I haven't decided." Are you interested in personal relationships, or are you rather a loner?
If I'm a loner, it's not by choice.
The picture becomes clear to me, said Verini. Don't worry. We shall provide you with the necessary conditions for creating, and when you have finished, we'll listen to your works and probably make an offer to purchase certain author's rights. We have at our disposal a team of top-notch lawyers who will guarantee you a fair deal that will, of course, deprive your heirs of their due, but in exchange for that, what happens to you will remain our secret.
Verini handed him the key to his room.
Enjoy your stay.
Eddie turned and began following the bellhop away from the desk. He didn't see the psychologist reading the folder and then pushing a button below the counter. Eddie stepped back as the elevator doors slid open and a very pretty girl emerged. Absorbed in a conversation on her cell phone, she stumbled over some luggage a bellhop had left on the floor and staggered right into the young musician's arms. He caught her and was instantly captivated by the feel and smell of her. She smiled.
"I apologize for being so clumsy."
She paused awkwardly.
"My name's Amanda. Did you come a long way? I'm from Queensland myself. I play the clarinet. I came here because..."
Leo Verini observed them as they entered the elevator. When the doors closed, he exposed his even white teeth in a perfect smile and waved to the bellhop.
"Something for the soul," he said quietly.
They seemed made for each other. The young man will come to know the sweetness of expectation, only to plunge into the abyss of despair that such personal contacts can cause. I would not be surprised if he creates some of his best works before he takes his own life. By the way, does Amanda actually play the clarinet?
I doubt it.
Verini shrugged.
No matter. He'll be so enthralled, he won't even think of asking her to play for him until after she's already left him.
He sniffed the air.
You'd better spray the area. I can still smell her perfume.
Something based on pheromones? Suggested the bellhop with a smile.
Created in our lab, confirmed Verini. Why would such a nice, talented, healthy young man want to die unless he'd experienced something like that and then had it taken away from him?
Satisfied that things would proceed as planned, Verini began checking the details on the hotel's next arrival.
I'm Melanie Simmons. This story is titled The Dead Letter Office by Matthew Marinette. Here's a good one, Callie said. The left corner of her mouth was curved up like a dog-eared page, her trickster smile. In her hand was a crumpled parchment with ancient letters scrawled messily across it. Please strike down this impious philosopher with your mighty lightning. Unsigned. Horatio moved beside her and tried to stare over her shoulder. Addressed to whom? Zeus, of course. She tossed the last parchment away and picked up a fresh letter from the pile, this one on vellum. Oh, and here, another good one. Mighty Ares, vanquisher, lion-hearted, widow, sorrow, blah, blah, aid us in our coming battle. Something, something about Egypt and Octavian. This one does go on. Signed, Mark Antony. She discarded the letter over her shoulder, chuckling. Oh, well, I'm sure it wasn't important. I suppose in the end it doesn't seem like any of them are. Horatio looked around at the stacks of crumbling paper slouching into the horizon. Once, the letters may have been sorted, but in the eons since the shelves had caved in or toppled down, and now papers were blowing about in a breeze that swooped in from shattered windows. Why are we here? To look, Callie said. For what? Ho-ho, Callie said suddenly, drawing up a new missive written on torn paper. Now this one is from you. She flashed Horatio a sideways glance, eyes blazing cruelly. Let's see here. Hard to read. Oh, it's to Venus. Please let Callie fall in love with me. She paused for a moment after she finished it, but her smile hadn't faded. Well, Horatio... I'm surprised. Horatio felt his cheeks begin to burn as he contemplated hiding behind a bookshelf. I never thought you'd find that, he blurted. I guess I should have told you before, but... Oh, no, please, she said, throwing the letter back into the pile. I'm not surprised about that. I've known that forever. I'm just surprised you believed in Venus. She was about to pick up another letter when Horatio stepped in front of her. You've known that forever? Callie looked at him and shrugged, her smile diminishing but enduring. Well, not literally forever, but close enough. So, he stumbled. What does that mean? It means I've known for a long time, she said, her voice less playful now. It means maybe. Maybe? Callie looked away and picked up another letter. Yes, Horatio. Maybe. In time. But here, this. This is the end of time, Callie. In one direction. Maybe I'll love you when the sun first shines. Her left-handed smile renewed, mocking him, but her muted eyes betrayed it. Maybe I'll love you when life begins in the sea. That's not funny. Horatio turned to the pile and picked one up. It was a prayer for a dying father. He as quickly threw it away. Then I want to find one from you. Callie's smile vanished as she turned back to the page in her hand. I only ever made one, and it might not be here. She discarded the letter in her hand and picked up another. Why? Horatio asked. Because it was delivered? I hope so. What did you pray for? Kelly fell to her knees next to the heap of paper inside. The same thing as you. Horatio nearly launched himself into the air, he felt so light. You did? Then it must have come true. He tried to smile at her, but she wasn't looking. She was digging into the pile faster now, skimming each letter quickly before throwing it away. I do love you, Callie. Her head fell. No, Horatio, she said. I prayed for the same thing you did. Exactly the same thing. I prayed that I fall in love with you. Horatio could suddenly feel gravity again. I don't understand. Why? Why would you pray for that? She looked back at him, now tightly clutching at a ball of letters. Her eyes had gone cold. Because it's just you and me, Horatio. I don't want to spend eternity like this. I need to know. I need to know if I can love you. He stumbled for words. I don't know what to say. You don't need to say anything, she said, turning away. Just help me look. Horatio fell to his knees next to her and looked into the stack of letters. It was just one unsorted pile in a sea of thousands. This could take forever. Forever is what we have, she said. Horatio could only nod at that. Then he picked up a letter and began to read.
I'm Eric Benrood. The story title is Emergency Scenarios by Kelly Sandoval. It was 2 weeks until the ship landed back on Earth, and Tricia figured out that meant now or never. She had to tell Jazz how she felt, because once they reached Earth, it'd all be different. Instead of being two of a half dozen kids, they'd be two of millions. It wouldn't matter anymore that Tricia could put on a space suit in under 2 minutes, because the Earth teens would know how to drive, play guitar, and swim. The sort of things Tricia had only seen in movies. Once Jazz met people like that, he wouldn't have time for Tricia. So she had to act fast. It was, you could even say, an emergency. Tricia was good at emergencies. She'd even been safety officer for 2 years at Mars High, which was also Mars Middle and Mars Elementary. With 6 kids, one room really did the trick. She knew how to stay calm, put on her spacesuit, and proceed to the nearest shuttle. If only that was all it took to ask someone out. Tricia didn't even know where to start. Invite him to see a movie? Considering they'd been watching movies together since they were toddlers, Tricia worried that might not get the point across. She needed help. Since she'd take a long walk between domes without a spacesuit before she talked to her dad about this, that really only left one option. At Iona, she called.
turning to look at the screen that was currently displaying the Martian skyline. Jazz preferred beach scenes, but even the idea of oceans filled Tricia with a nervous, fluttering feeling, and they both avoided images of the forest and green fields their parents liked so much. Trees were just so weird-looking. "How can I assist you?" Adiona asked, in the two-level voice all computers seem to have. "Bring up the emergency simulator. I want to run a scenario." The screen shifted black. "Scenario type?" Adiona asked. "Crew dynamics." "Ready." "Use crew profiles for Tricia and Jazz. Got it?" The screen filled with an image of the two of them posing by the Curiosity Monument. Jazz in a grease-stained jumpsuit flashing a victory sign, his arm slung around Trisha's shoulders. Tricia was looking down and away, giggling despite herself. "Conflict." Tricia asked Jazz to watch Moon Riot. "Run scenario." There was a pause. "Awaiting additional data," Adiona said. Tricia could almost swear it sounded bored. "That's it. That's the scenario. I asked Jazz to watch Moon Riot tonight. What happens?"
"I detect nothing of consequence."
"Details, Adiona." Tricia sat up, frowning at the screen. She would make this work. "What's the worst-case scenario?" Another pause. "You watch Moon Riot. Jazz says the original was better. You call him a purist. He calls you disloyal. A fighter ups. Jazz threatens to return to Mars. In a rage, you disable the sensors in your room and set fire to the ship. Everyone dies." Tricia shook her head, doing the best to chase away that particular chain of images. "Worst case scenario where no one dies?" "Much the same, but the fire is contained in time. You are imprisoned the moment we land." "I wouldn't do that, you know. You need to update your Tricia profile."
"Noted,"
Adiona replied. "What if I kissed him?" she asked. "You know, during the movie, before I lose it and kill everyone."
"A slight increase in the potential for worst-case scenario."
"Great. Tell someone you like them, increase your odds of wiping out your entire crew. Why did everything have to be so difficult? Who even cared about stupid Earth and stupid college? If they just stayed on Mars, she wouldn't be having this conversation. Instead, she'd be quietly waiting for Jazz to notice her, just like she had for the past year. So, not an ideal plan, but better than actually talking to him about it."
"How likely is this anyway?"
"Less than 0.00001%. "Well, as long as she didn't try this a billion times, they should be safe.
Adiona, does Jazz like me? I don't understand the scenario."
Tricia approached the screen, resting her forehead against the cool plastic. "Forget emergency scenarios. You have his profile. You even know he hates remakes, so you should know if he likes me."
"You don't have clearance to access his profile." Adiona made a buzz, something like a sigh, if a computer could sigh. "But I believe Jazz could provide you with an answer."
"Just ask?" "Just like that?
The chance that such a question will lead to the death of the crew is negligible."
"I can't."
"Timidity is a noted issue in your profile."
The door chimed softly, then opened. There was Jazz in torn jeans and a t-shirt from Mars Attacks, the band they'd formed for a month last year.
"Hey," he said, "everything okay?"
Adiona said it might be an emergency. "Adiona thinks everything is an emergency." She shot a glare at the screen. "I thought we could watch Moon Riot, and maybe I could ask you a question. Whatever your answer, I promise not to burn us alive." Jazz laughed, his low chuckle making Tricia shiver.
"You?"
"Adiona said I burned the ship. After you cruelly spurned my advances, of course."
"I wouldn't," Tricia object. "I mean, I didn't. I mean, what advances?"
"I haven't advanced them yet," he lowered his gaze, blushing. Tricia swallowed hard. She could do this. Timidity be damned.
"Well, maybe you should, and we'll both agree to stay away from lighters."
Their eyes met, and with that sweet, low grin that Tricia loved, Jazz advanced.
My name is Renita Banerjee, and the story that I'm about to read is titled Going Back for Seconds by Jez Patterson. Styler leaned towards the clock and pinched something from the air. I felt the room move. Everything move. She held it out to me and I dropped the paper plane. I'd spent all afternoon folding and refolding and never getting right. "A second," she said, pushing my grasping hands away and plucking the handkerchief from the top pocket of my jacket. Pinstriped, my suit a perfect miniaturized copy of my father's. Styler wrapped the second in it, made me put it inside the pocket. The one that carries things closest to your heart. Usually a man's wallet. Figures. Don't waste it, and for goodness sake, if you feel a sneeze coming on, use your sleeve. It would be wrong to say I forgot about that second. Right to say I didn't give it more than a glancing thought every now and again. What value a second when life ate up minutes, galloped through hours, gorged on days, and... "What do you want to do with this?" Helen asked, holding up the tiny suit. "Did you used to do ventriloquism?" "It was mine," I said, and saw her face was troubled yet fascinated. The suit was the only thing in the room cut in my father's image. I hadn't gone out of my way to disappoint him. Like all things financial were his natural gift, mine was falling way below people's expectations. Helen pulled a paper plane from the pocket. Badly made, a waste of time I had spent trying to do it. "There's something in the inside pocket. It's a handkerchief. Ugh, there's something in it." She held the handkerchief up by its collected corners and I reached forward and grabbed it before it could unfold, whereupon what sprinkled out would not be dried snot, but the second that Styler had given me. "The suit?" she reminded me, after I had spent a long time staring at the handkerchief. "Throw it out," I murmured, not looking at her or the suit. Helen huffed and left to file it in the charity or the shredding pile with the rest of my father's belongings. Styler hadn't been there at the funeral, or she might have been. There were many there to pay respects to my father. I stood at the front, Helen by my side, my relatives hanging back in other rows in order to be noticed but not appear too keen to find out what my father had left them. "Here to pay their respects," I thought, and wondered if the expression had once had a financial element to it. My father would have approved of that. "A second?" Helen asked me during the drive back from my father's house. "Your nanny left you a second. How are you going to spend that?" And there was that thought again, that we paid our respects, spent our time. Saved our sinking men, I thought, contriving in order to complete the list. She wasn't the nanny, she was the cook. I didn't have a nanny, I was supposed to keep myself busy. Employed. My father had always used the word employed, usually preceded by gainfully. Earn his respect, I quickly added to the list. Oh, God. Helen was driving and so only noticed the tears when they had finished. "So," she said gently, "you know what you want to do with it?" "Let it go," I said. She nodded, realizing I was referring to more than just the moment wrapped in the handkerchief. "He never has time for me, not even a single second. The complaint of any child, never mind if it had been true in my case." And Styler, not one to play games, not possessed of an enormous imagination, reflected in the solid, chunky meals she produced from my father's kitchen, reaching over to the clock and plucking a second to give to me. "Not here," I told Helen, back at his house. She bit her impatience, performed a U-turn, drove us back there. Helen stayed in the car, sensing this was a moment that her presence would either break or force into ridicule. I went up to my father's office, wanting to hand back the second so I wasn't left owing my father even that. The handkerchief had gone stale in that tiny jacket pocket, but the second had preserved its color. I opened it, let the second be sucked back into that past time. and as the door to that past moment opened, I saw my father sitting at his desk. The clock before him showed the time was the right one, the calendar on the wall the right day. He was always working, always surrounded by paper. But in that second, the floor and his desk were littered with balled up sheets. The latest attempt was before him, half completed, and already on the way to something that would never fly straight, never take to the air, never impress. I saw the anguish on his face as he tried, though. The second ended, but I had already lost the scene to my tears.
This is Kim Stamegna, and I'm reading The New Kid is No Angel by James Villaris. This was what I got for being nice to the new kid and inviting him to hang out. Reading through my comic collection in my bedroom, we've been arguing all morning. Choose to be a shapeshifter instead. You could just go wherever you wanted in secret. Because, I said, trying to maintain my composure, maybe you want to be seen. Like, there's the girl you think is pretty, but she only really likes tall guys. How is it going to help to be invisible? Isn't that your problem already, that you're invisible to girls? Well, it's not like the girls are crawling all over you either. I meant the universal you, I said. Oh, geez, what time is it? Yeah, it's getting late. I gotta go. I saw him to the door. We walked outside together. I could tell he was still mad at me. I had won most of the arguments, hands down. We probably wouldn't be spending any more Saturday mornings together. I still think super fast speed beats stretch ability, he said. I shrugged. Maybe, but not for a girl. You think about girls too much, he said, and then he unfolded his enormous wings and took off into the sky. His flapping lifted his heavy body higher, falling a bit, then lifting him still higher until a wind gust caught him and he glided in the direction of his house. Seemed slow and sweaty, I thought, and then teleported back to my bedroom.
You've been listening to Science Fiction Shorts on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Kurt Benroot. My team of volunteer readers and I thank you for listening in. And we would love to have you join us next time. Just a quick reminder, this program is available in podcast, and it is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. As always, our number is 832-5138, and that's 919-832-5138. If you're a fan of sci-fi and have something to say, we want to hear from you.